I want to talk about American Methodism and the White House. For this denomination of ours has been described as America's most characteristic church. And the description in these words: it's short on theology, long on good works, brilliantly organized, primarily middle class, frequently bigoted, incurably optimistic, zealously missionary, and touchingly confident of the essential goodness of the person next door. It exhibits all the chief American faults and virtues, and has done so for all its life. Since 1789, when George Washington was inaugurated as our first president, 41 men have held this nation's highest office, and each of them has either held membership or has attended church. The denominational breakdown shows that there have been 11 Episcopalians, 6 Presbyterians, 5 Methodists, 4 Unitarians, 4 Baptists, 3 Disciples of Christ, 2 Dutch Reformed, 2 Quakers, 1 Congregational, and 1 Roman Catholic. Thomas Jefferson, who considered himself a deist, attended the Unitarian and Episcopal churches on occasion, and Abraham Lincoln, though he never joined, attended the Presbyterian Church. But Lincoln had the highest regard for the Methodists. And on May the 18th, 1864, he said, "It is no fault in others that the Methodist Church sends more soldiers to the field, more nurses to the hospitals, and more prayers to heaven than any. God bless the Methodist Church. And blessed be all the churches, and blessed be God, who in this our great trial giveth us the churches." And history records for us that his dear and perhaps closest friend, Bishop Matthew Simpson, was chosen to deliver his final funeral oration. The Methodist Episcopal Church, as we all know, was organized at that Christmas conference at Lovely Lane in Baltimore in 1784. And in the conference of 1788, Bishops Francis Asbury and Thomas Coke were instructed to go and call on the newly elected President George Washington. They did so, and they offered the new president the prayers and support of the Methodists. And that was the beginning of a long association and connection between the Methodist Church and the White House. It's been said that you cannot read the history of the United States in the 19th century apart from the history of Methodism. Be that as it may, the facts are that the 5 Methodist presidents were all elected in the 19th century. And they were born in states where Methodism continues to be a vital and active witness in the late 20th century. James Knox Polk and Andrew Johnson were born in North Carolina. Ulysses S. Grant, Rutherford B. Hayes, and William McKinley were born in Ohio. 3 presidents were educated in our United Methodist-related colleges: James Buchanan at Dickinson, William McKinley at Allegheny, and Richard Nixon at the Duke University Law School. We take a brief glimpse at these 5 Methodist presidents. James Knox Polk's parents took him as an infant to be baptized in the Presbyterian Church, but the pastor refused to perform the service unless both parents professed their faith in accordance with Presbyterian doctrine. For his mother, that was no problem, but his father refused, and an argument between Mr. Polk and the clergyman followed, and the former stalked out with his wife and the unbaptized child. In 1833, James Polk attended a Methodist camp meeting and was profoundly moved by the preaching of the Reverend John McFerrin. He was converted and became a Methodist privately, affirming his devotion to Methodism. He married Sarah Childress, a well-educated woman at the exclusive Moravian Female Academy in Salem, North Carolina. She was a strict Moravian. And in the White House, she and the president refused to attend the theater or horse races. She banned dancing and card playing and alcoholic drinking in the White House, refused to let visitors come to the White House on Sunday. And on his deathbed, President Polk summoned the preacher under whom he had been converted, now Bishop McFerrin, who baptized him a Methodist before he died. Andrew Johnson attended Methodist services with his wife, Eliza McCardle, who at 16 married at a younger age than any of the first ladies. He occasionally attended Catholic Mass, defended Catholicism from its critics. He never attended a single day of school, barely taught himself to read, but his better educated wife tutored him, teaching him to write and to figure math and to greatly improve his reading and writing. And while he labored in the tailor shop, she read aloud to him. Johnson, though a Methodist, never formally joined the church. Rutherford B. Hayes neither smoked nor drank, but married Lucy Webb of Cincinnati, a devout Methodist, and she was the first of the first ladies to graduate from college. They attended church regularly. Lucy Hayes vigorously opposed slavery and convinced her husband to abandon the Whig Party for the anti-slavery Republican Party. And as the first lady, she brought her zeal for temperance to the White House and was nicknamed Lemonade Lucy. She banned all alcoholic beverages, but I want to tell you something that history, most historians don't record. On one occasion, the reception for the Grand Duke of Russia in 1877, Lemonade Lucy allowed wine to be served. The Women's Christian Temperance Union hailed her policy in gratitude, commissioned a full-length portrait of her, which now hangs in the White House. I think you would find it interesting that in the Hayes administration, a typical day in the White House began with prayer. And in the evening, the family gathered together for prayer, for music, and hymn singing. And as president, he introduced the practice of group hymn sings in the White House on Sunday night. And we are told that they set a good example for the American family and gained respect for their hospitality, their simplicity, and their modesty. It was the Hayes who introduced the custom of Easter egg rolling for the children on Easter Monday on the White House lawn. Hayes wrote after he left the presidency, "I try to be a Christian. I want to be a Christian. I want to help to do Christian work." And he gave freely both of his money and his time, contributed 25% to the construction cost of a new Methodist church, and bore another 25% of its reconstruction cost after it burned down. Ulysses S. Grant, as a youth, rarely went to church. But this all changed when he fell in love with Julia Boggs Dent of St. Louis and began with her attending Methodist worship services. During his final struggle with cancer, the Reverend John Philip Newman of Metropolitan Methodist Church in Washington called on Grant regularly, urging him to confirm his faith in God and the church. And after one such visit, Reverend Newman announced to the press that he had baptized the president at his request. The family members later disputed that, saying that Grant had tolerated Newman's visits and bedside prayers because they comforted Mrs. Grant, and he did not want to be rude to the minister whom he greatly admired. Grant had little use for organized religion, but was always expressing belief in God, in the Bible, and in an afterlife. He said in a speech in Des Moines, "Leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private school. Keep the church and state forever separate." And he wrote, "Hold fast to the Bible as the anchor of your liberties. Write its precepts in your hearts and practice them in your lives. To the influence of this book, we are indebted for the progress made in true civilization. And to this, we must look as our guide in the future." William McKinley, the fifth Methodist president, was brought up in a devout Christian home. At 10 years of age, he professed his faith in a revival meeting and joined the church at age 16. Throughout his life, he was a devout, active Methodist, a regular churchgoer in Canton, Ohio. He was a Sunday school superintendent at the First Methodist Church. In Washington, he attended Metropolitan Methodist Church. And at his inauguration, he kissed the Bible, which was open to 2 Chronicles 1:10. "Give me now, O God, wisdom and knowledge, that I may go out and come in before the people. For who can judge this thy people that is so great?" As president, he invited people to come and sing hymns in the Blue Room on Sunday evenings. And among his favorites were "Nearer My God to Thee" and "Lead Kindly Light." In 1899, he summarized his credo in these words: "My belief embraces the divinity of Christ and a recognition of Christianity as the mightiest factor in world civilization." He maintained his faith to the end. But he was overheard softly reciting the Lord's Prayer as he was being prepared for surgery after being shot. Teddy Roosevelt, who succeeded him on September 14, 1901, remarked to the Methodist chaplain of the United States Senate as he went to address Congress, "Your church is the Church of America." Calvin Coolidge spoke at the unveiling of the only equestrian statue on public land in Washington which does not honor a military hero. On the occasion of the unveiling of the statue of Bishop Francis Asbury, that prophet of the long road, Coolidge said, "Asbury ranks as one of the builders of this nation. He printed the map of this country with the hoofbeats of his horses." And he closed that moment with one of the greatest lines: "We build monuments to men who do not need them." Some of us were present in Baltimore in 1966 when President Lyndon Johnson spoke to the bicentennial of Methodist beginnings in America. And many here know that the links of historic Methodism to the White House includes the action of delegates in 1980 in sending a delegation headed by Bishop William R. Cannon to the White House for a meeting with President Jimmy Carter regarding the Americans held hostage by the Iranians. We know that President Carter married a Methodist, Rosalind Smith of Plains, Georgia. And so the action we took here, requesting a delegation headed by Bishop Woody White to call on President Clinton, has many historic precedents. In a few moments, we will be eyewitnesses to a current page of Methodist and White House history as we welcome the most forthright United Methodist witness to be in the White House in 95 years. And the national publicity she has brought to United Methodism is perhaps without historical precedent. Reviewing Methodism in the White House, I would close by quoting briefly John Wesley and Martin Marty. John Wesley had only one fear: "I'm not afraid that the people called Methodist should ever cease to exist, either in America or England, but I am afraid that they should only exist as a dead sect, having the form of religion without the power." Martin Marty, our contemporary historian from the University of Chicago, said in my hearing, "Methodism was the hottest lava flowing in America in the 19th century. Beware if it heats up again in the 21st. May our prayer be, Lord, do it again." Thank you.